thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 38 for the 17th of February, 2009. Ebooks Redux. I'm Dan Cohen. And we're here for episode 38 of the Digital Campus podcast, what we like to think of as the juiciest podcast in higher ed and technology and the museum and library world, the digital world that we're all entering. I'm Dan Cohen from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason. I'm here with the other regular hosts of Digital Campus, Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Dan.
And Tom Scheinfeld. Hey, Tom.
Hi, guys.
Welcome. We're all suffering from colds or sick kids, things like that, but we're going to forge ahead, aren't we? And as I hinted at the top of the podcast, talking about us as the juiciest podcast, we were all, I guess, relieved, although I'm waiting to hear Tom and Mills on this point, about the demise of Juicy Campus, the open, anonymous wiki where people on campuses could dump smeary sorts of things about their colleagues and other students and have everyone find out about it. Are we sad that this wiki is gone, this wiki where you could put all kinds of rumors from campus?
Not me. I'm not going to miss it at all. Of course, I actually never went to the website, so it's not like I'm going to miss something that I was using.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not going to miss it either. It's not something I frequented, but and I mean, I think this is like particularly destructive. I think we've seen a lot of stories where people have been harassed viciously on Facebook and MySpace, even to the point of suicide, and having a site dedicated to that kind of harassment and smearing and vicious gossip seems like a horrible idea, and it's probably good that it's gone.
Well, yeah, I mean, I of course am speaking from ignorance as well. I never visited the site, but let me play devil's advocate for just a minute. You know, a couple of other anonymous wiki sites that have taken off and that people have found valuable are things like WikiLeaks, where they post, you know, anonymously leaked documents from governments. You know, obviously, maybe this is not a moral equivalent to talk about Juicy Campus, but one could imagine maybe a post on Juicy Campus that did reveal something rotten going on campus. Is that a reason to keep it around, or was the potential for abuse so rife that it just isn't something like WikiLeaks, where it's generally you know, documents that probably should be getting out, but tight-fisted governments are keeping them closed?
No, I think that there are other ways of getting that information out than this. And so, and I'm sure that that's one of the reasons it's now failed, is because it just turned out to be not as popular as its buzz.
You think Facebook had some role in this? I mean, just not in terms of going and kneecapping them in mob style, but just in terms of, you know, you can probably get your juicy news from Facebook anyway.
I think that's probably, to be honest, what killed it. Not any kind of backlash amongst the students about talking badly about people. I think it probably is that there are better places that they can do this. They can do this on Facebook, and they don't need a dedicated site. Facebook provides enough channels for that.
Okay, well, another campus story that caught our eye. Goodbye, Juicy Campus, and goodbye also to Ruckus. Ruckus.com, RUCKUS.com, and I guess the umbrella organization or company called Total Music from Sony, which was, you know, just I think 6 months ago on this podcast, we were talking about legislation in the United States that was sort of forcing campuses to, you know, to subscribe to a service like Ruckus, which for those of our listeners who hadn't heard of it, kind of offered a blanket license for streaming audio music on campuses so that universities could kind of feel better about music sharing, or you know, sort of cover themselves legally from lawsuits by subscribing to a service that basically did give free music to everyone on campus. You know, every dorm, every student would have a license essentially to just grab whatever music they wanted legally from Ruckus, rather than, of course, from BitTorrent or any of these other trading sites out there. Are we as sad to see Ruckus go? Was it just an idea that really had, you know, no business model?
I think it's just another example of, A, they're up against a much more successful service like iTunes and Rhapsody, and B, the free economy of the internet is pretty powerful. I mean, it's in this case an illegal economy, but it's still the demand for free stuff, and especially among younger people, free music and video, whether they get it legally or illegally, is pretty big. And so I think it's really hard to compete with that.
But I'm assuming that iTunes is not widely used by students. I mean, I'm assuming they're still stealing music, right?
I don't know.
At 99 cents, are students buying 500 songs for $500 from iTunes?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say. I think some of them probably are. I think interface wise, I think there are some technically savvy students. The more technically savvy are probably thinking, well, I can get this on a peer-to-peer network. But right now, I think iTunes kind of is possibly the default choice for a lot of people. And at 99 cents, it's not too painful to buy a song. I'm sure there's still tons of, you know, obviously there's still tons of piracy going on, but I think that iTunes probably has a pretty substantial share of the market just because it's like the default thing to do. I think they've made it so seamless and so frictionless to get music on iTunes. And who knows? I mean, the bill might even be going to their parents. That it just doesn't seem. It just seems like that they're probably using a combination of both, or certain students are using one, certain students are using the other.
Right. I mean,
I see so many students just like walking through our student union buildings. So many students using iTunes as their organizational software. That you know, whether they're even if they are downloading the stuff illegally, they're using iTunes as their way of managing their music files. And
right,
like Tom
right.
said, it's just so, you know, so simple then, like, oh, I really need this. And so then you just click and you get it for 99 cents, and that's pretty painless.
Yeah, I actually should also mention, I forgot to mention it to you guys before the podcast. There is this there was another piece of news in this area this week. There's this thing called Qtracks. That was the name of it, Qtracks.com. And it looks like it's going to be a free peer-to-peer network, but one that's run by or at least sanctioned by the music industry, and it's going to be ad-supported. So I think that the music industry, I think, are worried about it enough that that they're still trying to find ways to some business models that can support this kind of peer-to-peer sharing. So this is just a brand new story that came out. So I think you know, Qtracks may be something to watch, but my guess is that it's probably going to go the way of Ruckus and these other music industry efforts.
They have saved themselves a decade by just acquiring Napster in 1999 and just sticking ads in it?
Probably, yeah. Probably.
It sounds like that's what that is. Well, speaking of downloading, on the more up and up, we were pretty excited, I think, the three of us, by an announcement by YouTube this week about the potential now to download videos from their site. And not only that, but to download it under different licensing than the standard license that is on YouTube. Namely, they've adopted Creative Commons licenses, and they specifically seem to be gearing this program toward universities that want to put things like lectures on their site and allow, for instance, students to download it and stick it on their video iPod, or to lifelong learners who want to grab this stuff when their, you know, connection might be flaky, or when they're on the train or plane or somewhere without Wi-Fi. Mills, you've really been talking a lot about this on the podcast since its inception 2 years ago. What's your take on this? Is this an exciting development, or is the fact that iTunes U has been doing something basically like this for a while just make it more of the same?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether this is going to take off or not. I mean, earlier this afternoon, I was checking some of the comments from various in the blogosphere about this, and you know, YouTubers seem kind of wholly unimpressed and actually kind of pissed off about it. Like, why would we be paying for something that we get for free now?
We should mention that, right? You can choose as part of the partners program to charge for the download.
Right. And so a lot of content is going to start to be downloaded. And I mean, one of the things I've noticed on YouTube is that, you know, they've not to, I don't know when it happened, but the 10-minute video segment limit has evaporated because now, you know, entire TV shows are showing up there, you know, 30, 40 minutes at a time. And so I would guess that that was sort of a preliminary to this. Now you can pay to have those things permanently. I, you know, YouTube was built on this free sharing model, and so I'm just not sure, especially because there's so many open source applications out there that let you rip video out of YouTube anyway and save them locally. It's going to be interesting to see whether they run up against that as a problem. And the other thing is, and I guess some smart people at Google are probably thinking about this already, but you know, YouTube has been you know, the sort of the most popular website on the internet for a while, and is this central repository for video. But it's not the only major repository. And increasingly, there are these aggregation sites that are aggregating video, aggregating, you know, images and things like that, aggregating airplane fares, places like Kayak and this sort of thing. And increasingly, I think younger people are going to start turning to these aggregation sites. Because then they get, you know, all the possible video of their favorite rock band or whatever it might be. And so it's going to be interesting to see whether that also becomes a problem for YouTube at the same time that they're trying to figure out a way to monetize YouTube.
Well, I think that's the key here for Google. I mean, YouTube has got to be a huge drain on Google. I can't imagine that they're recouping recouping the kind of bandwidth costs that they're incurring with the pretty minimal ads that you find on YouTube. I just think that they probably are feeling like, especially in this economy, that they really need to figure out a way to monetize this. I think actually the biggest story here is the Creative Commons aspect of it, where that it seems like more and more Creative Commons is becoming a mainstream thing, that this is that Creative Commons are being built into these other Creative Commons licensing is being built into these other services, and that's the way that I think that open access is really going to advance. That if there's a standard set of licenses and everybody understands the terms of those licenses, I think that if YouTube's doing it and Flickr is doing it and all of these popular web services are doing it, libraries and archives, museums and universities are going to start looking at it and saying, well, maybe this is something we can do. And maybe if this is something that's commonly done on the web, and that our users are going to understand the terms when they take the information that we're giving to them, then maybe this isn't something we need to be scared of, and maybe we can unlock some of our content. That to me seems like maybe the biggest story of all of this.
Yeah, I think what's going to be interesting to follow on that is with these Creative Commons licenses, and we've already seen this in the last 2 months, there have been a few of these new aggregation sites that are specifically kind of faux university sites, you know, the best of academic lectures, or there's this, what was it? There was Peer-to-Peer University came out, and some other of these kinds of tests of what's the other one? Yeah, University of the People, that are sort of charging for access to learning materials, but they're also using these Creative Commons or open access embeddable videos on their website. So, you know, I suspect that's going to give, you know, your provosts, your standard provosts, a little bit of pause when they see that and are starting to think about, you know, yeah, sticking a quick Creative Commons license on some of this content, for, you know, especially from star professors, which is the stuff that gets picked up and kind of aggregated on these sites.
Yeah, definitely. It's
especially because if the material that's being videotaped or, you know, recorded and then put into YouTube is teaching, then that actually belongs to the universities, not to the professors. You know, it's work made for hire, and so the universities actually own that.
Well, that is tricky. You know, maybe on a future podcast we'll get someone from the university system that's doing the most with this is University of California, which has an initiative called UCTV. And I know that I think Artie Berkeley is trying over the next year or two to digitize basically every single lecture they have on campus. I mean, they have a comprehensive system at the University of California to do this, and they're making a lot of that available. I'm not sure what license it's under. That would be interesting to find out. Maybe we'll, since we've kind of danced around this issue on the podcast, maybe we'll come back to that. We need to move on to across the campus at Google, from the headquarters for YouTube on one side to the folks at Google Earth who released Google Earth 5. And while the news media was focused on the fact that Google Earth 5 added oceanographic elements, you can now go under the sea and see all the undersea mountains and underwater tributaries and all these things that I get out of my depth on very quickly, as you can tell by my description of what goes on under the sea. But what did, I think, capture us as historians was the new history bar at the top of Google Earth 5. It's not available everywhere. In fact, I was kind of playing around with it, and in many places it's either not available at all or only has a few years to it. But what it basically allows you to do is kind of a time machine effect right within Google Earth, where you can slide the bar and go back through satellite imagery of that area, back through time. There is one area, and I can't remember if it's Berlin or Washington, but they have done a couple of cities back to World War II where they have older satellite imagery. And, you know, it's pretty fascinating. My first thought was, hey, this is, you know, something that certainly if you were interested in urbanization or architecture, you could kind of use as a kind of study piece for a course. It'd be interesting to see if more of these older maps and satellite scans get up there. Tom and Mills, what do you think other potential uses for this are?
Well, I think, you know, I think one is already there's a ton of historical content that people have loaded up as KML layers for Google Earth. I mean, I just did one of historical maps of my neighborhood, and, you know, one from a Civil War cartographer. I'd live near the Manassas battlefield. One, you know, from the 1920s from the Geological Survey, one from the 50s from the Corps of Engineers, and then one from Google Earth. And, you know, and so I have them just sort of set up as layers. But if you had them in a way that you could peel the layers away, then that would be, I think, really interesting. And so those who are trying to integrate, you know, geographic information into their teaching in particular will find this really useful.
Yeah, I think I think it could be useful in teaching. I'm a little harder pressed to see the kind of research uses for this. But I think maybe people more creative than I will chime in on the forums, on the blog, and on Twitter, and let me know what their ideas on this are. But that's my initial sense is that this is probably a useful teaching tool and something of a novelty, but maybe not something that's going to be useful at least to historians in the near term.
Right. Well, both good points. I guess we'll have to see if people add in additional information on top of, you know, what sort of ships with the software, these old satellite images. And at the same time, think about whether anyone ends up using this in their courses. Of course, we'd love to hear from our audience if people have good ideas for how they use the history slider bar in Google Earth 5. Let us know on digitalcampus.tv or feedback at digitalcampus.tv or on Twitter at Digital Campus, where we're excited to discover there's already 150 people following us. So thanks to all of our listeners. Well, we'll take a short break and come back with our featured story on a topic we covered a little over a year ago. Well, as we mentioned in the news roundup, we always love to visit stories we've covered here over the last 2 years on Digital Campus. And one that we really felt we had to revisit because of developments over the last 2 weeks was a story that we covered on Digital Campus 16 in December of 2007. so about 14 months ago. We covered the launch of Amazon's Kindle. Yes, it's already been more than a year since the Kindle came out. And, of course, this past week on February 9th, we saw the launch of the Kindle 2 already, in a much sleeker design, much thinner, and it's got round buttons rather than square. We'll talk about that in just a second. And a bunch of new functionality in it, like the ability to synchronize books between various devices, and the potential, at least hinted at in the announcement, that Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon, when he announced the Kindle 2, also talked about perhaps releasing Kindle books on other devices like the iPhone. At the same time, over the last couple of weeks since our last podcast, we saw a really interesting development by Google Books, which I can now gloat about, which was precisely my prediction in the end of our year wrap-up in 2008 here on the Digital Campus podcast, where I said that I really thought something that would shake up 2009 would be the launch of Google Books Mobile, and indeed it did launch over the past couple of weeks, faster than I thought it would, with 1.5 million public domain books, at least in the United States, and outside of the United States, people can access via their mobile devices 620,000 books. And if you take a look at this, you can access either the page views or the OCR text, that is the transcribed text. And a really nice little functionality that Google Books added is if their OCR is lousy and you see a paragraph that you don't think is correct, you can just kind of click on the paragraph and it takes you right to the page scan so you can double check it yourself. So huge developments in the realm of ebook reading. I have to say, looking back, and we listened a little bit, Tom and Mills, before the podcast today to episode 16. And we're going to use a little bit of flashback here in a moment to go back and hear what we say. But I guess we'll start out by saying we were generally skeptical, weren't we?
Oh, yes. Very
yeah,
skeptical.
Yeah, I think we were. From what little I've listened to of that old show, we got it wrong, I think, or at least a few of us did.
Okay, well let's bring on three new guests to the podcast. I guess these are the three of us from 2007. I'm having a mental image of us with goatees. Ghosts of podcast past when we were. Less wise than we are today. Mills, I guess we'll embarrass you first. I remember you had something to say about the design of the Kindle One. Let's dial back our magical podcast and see what we said in, Mills, what you said in 2007.
The second problem is just that it's just ugly. And, you know, it's and when I first saw it, I thought, God, they should have hired a designer from Apple or some place where they do actually good industrial design, because right. There is absolutely right. Nothing that's appealing about this. It's just blah. I mean, they could have made it putty colored and it would have been worse.
Oh, Mills. Well, wow, you did not spare any expense in your criticism of the industrial design. Would you like to correct yourself now that you've seen the svelte new Kindle 2?
Well, of course, I haven't held one in my hand because that's not possible yet unless you're, I guess, a close friend of Jeff Bezos. But I still think it's ugly. It did take me back to the days of the IBM PC when you could have a PC in any color you wanted as long as that color was putty. And this, you can have it in any color you want as long as that color is apparently putty. That's what it looks like on my screen anyway. And so, like, didn't they learn something from the 90s or the 80s? But also, I have to say, it's just too darn big. You know, okay, they make a big deal about how thin it is, but it doesn't fit in anybody's pocket. Now, other ebook readers like your iPhone fit in your pocket. And so this just doesn't fit. I don't know what they were thinking. I still don't like it.
I agree with Mills on that. I think, Dan, you know, when you and I were talking the other day, I think when this news first broke, and one of the things that doesn't seem to make sense to either of us is the fact that it still has a keyboard, which it seems to me like including a keyboard on an ebook reader is like including a pencil with every book you purchase. It just, it's like you don't need the keyboard to actually read this material. And so I think, you know, taking up half the screen or a third of the screen or a third of the size of the device with a keyboard that you're only going to occasionally use seems like a mistake. I think the other thing I think about it is that they've gone, instead of going for shrinking the height and the width of this thing, they've gone for a thinness. I sort of feel the same way about this as I do about the MacBook Air, where, you know, Apple went for the very thin computer, and what they should have done is go for the very small computer, which we see like netbooks have totally taken off, and it's largely because they're so small, and you can kind of put them in a, if you're a woman, you can put them in a purse, or if you're a guy, you could maybe even fit a really small one in your jacket pocket, or it just seems like the going for thinness is kind of the wrong way to go. And so I think the design still, as Mill said a year or more ago, is still kind of a problem for this device.
Right. Well, I seem to remember, you know, our criticism, and I guess my criticism is that, you know, if you're going to have an ebook reader, and I think I have general issues about ebook reading, which I need to get over, I guess, because I think it's, you know, it is a more impressive device than the Kindle one. And if someone threw it in my lap, I probably would take it. I agree with you, Tom, that there's a kind of device confusion here where when I think about books, I want the immersive experience. I don't want to be thinking about the device. And so when I look at a Kindle and I see a keyboard, I'm thinking computer. I'm not thinking book. And I don't quite understand why it's there, as you said. I mean, in fact, there's almost a strange irony in that I sometimes think my iPhone should have a keyboard, but if I had an e-reader, I would want it to be like the iPhone with no keyboard, because then you just have a flat surface that you can read off of. I'm sort of very confused. I know it's there because, you know, to be able to do searches, for instance, from new books, you have to download new books from the device. It doesn't plug in as the iPhone does to iTunes or a computer device where you can use a keyboard very quickly, although there is a keyboard on a virtual one on the iPhone too. But I guess it's also there to write annotations and things like that. But of course, there again, and I guess we'll get to this in just a second, when we do a flashback to me, you know, there's a question of, well, if I'm going to be doing annotations, then I kind of want my all-purpose device, don't I? I want my computer, not a dedicated ebook reader.
Right, and I think actually that your analogy to the iPhone there is exactly, or your comparison to the iPhone there is exactly right. Like the iPhone probably should have a physical keyboard, because if you want to like write a long email, you could do that. But the Kindle probably could use the pop-up touchscreen keyboard that the iPhone has. If I imagine that would be enough to search for the title of a book you want to buy, or you know, write a quick annotation on a page. So that I think is a good comparison.
And yeah. And why can't you download music on your Kindle?
Right, that's right. So if you're going to be carrying around a device, yeah, you'd want it to be more flexible than this. You know, while I'm disparaging it, though, it does seem like 2009, and this was one of our top 10 stories for 2009 or upcoming. Our prediction that was that ebooks were going to be very big this year, but I've really got my eye on this PaperLogic ebook reader. It uses the same e-ink, but it's in an 8.5 by 11 form factor, and it's very thin. It's about a quarter inch thin, and it doesn't have a keyboard. The whole thing just looks like a piece of paper, like a small stack of paper. And that to me seems like, especially when you think about the potential for, you know, literally just taking a PDF and sticking it on a device like that, where it's not going to be shrunk down to the size of the Kindle thing, then you can imagine really having, okay, if I need to take 500 student papers with me to grade, I could take it on a device like that, because it's, you know, it will look like a bunch of documents. Things get reformatted on the Kindle, and the screen for me is just too small again to get that immersive reading.
I actually think in that's a that that's a that device kind of pushes the technology one step further. But I actually think all of these devices we're seeing right now are kind of intermediary devices. I think that that coming down the pike in the next couple of years, and that there are prototypes of these already available, not available to us, but that are out there, are things like flexible displays, essentially displays that you could fold up and put in your pocket or roll up and put in your bag. So you could use them in very much the same way that you use a newspaper or a magazine now. I think when we get to that stage, then this is going to start being really interesting.
Okay, well, we've been focusing on device and design. Let's take this a little further. Tom, I think we need to hear from your past. let's roll back the clock and see, because you were making a good point about this on episode 16 about the history of ebook readers, and let's hear what you had to say about that.
The Sony Reader, which by many accounts is a better reader, has been out for a year. And this thing, it just doesn't strike me as this, wonderfully, game-changing device. E-book readers have been out since at least the late 90s.
Well, Tom, that was a pretty good comment about the history of ebook readers. You agree? I mean, why there have been this sort of long history that we forget about. We often think of the Kindle as the first ebook reader for some reason, but why haven't they taken off? And why are we still sitting here talking about will they flourish or not?
Well, yeah, I was right that they've been around for a long time. What I was wrong about is how this is different. And I really do actually think, looking back now at the last year, it is different. And the difference is really Amazon. I think the fact that this thing has an internet connection and a connection that connects you directly to Amazon and makes it very, very easy to get new content onto the device so that you can just kind of have this device and it connects right up to Amazon. It's kind of the seamless experience of finding and buying and reading books. I think that really is the difference. At first, I was kind of skeptical as to, why is Amazon, which is essentially like a warehousing and shipping company now, why are they producing hardware? But that is exactly why, because it allows them. It's another distribution channel for these products that they house.
Right. I mean, it seems like they're clearly trying to replicate the iTunes plus iPod combination. So you have it's an ecosystem for their ebooks that's sort of self-reinforcing. You're in an airport, you're about to get on a plane, you want to grab a book, you just grab it over the air in 60 seconds from the store. It, if you're on page 200 and you get home and you want to read the rest on your computer, you can sync it up. You know, all the things that we're kind of used to doing with an iPod can now happen versus something like, reading on those old Palm Pilots where, you didn't have that kind of network environment for book sales and synchronization.
Yeah, I think that's it. That's exactly it. It's this ecosystem, and in some ways, it's a more advanced ecosystem, or at least a closer knit ecosystem than even the iTunes Music Store. Although iTunes has recently moved to having this feature, but the fact that I think that you can just get it over the air. You can do that now on the iPhone too with applications and music. But the fact that it really doesn't connect to your computer at all. It is the device. It's the thing that's always with you and has everything you need. I think that changes things.
Right. But in creating this kind of walled garden, though, it is kind of problematic for the uses that we would have for it, right? I mean, giving, for instance, your students, a USB key with the course documents or something and giving it to them for their Kindle, they got to go through this Byzantine process of emailing themselves the PDFs at their Kindle email address. I mean, it's not an open device. It makes it really hard to do some of these other kinds of things we want to do with it. I'm sorry, Mills, I interrupted.
Yeah, I was just going to say much the same thing, which is I think for their core target market, the readers who are bonded to the Amazon network, they'll sell a lot of these. I think they're going to have a hard time expanding beyond that because for all the reasons that we've given already. So I think that within their core market, it'll be a good marketing and sales device. Beyond their market, I think they're going to have a hard time with it.
Yeah, I think it's clearly the way that they've designed it and the way it's been positioned. I think the Kindle is clearly a consumer product. It's not, I don't think it's something that's geared towards research and writing and collaboration, education, any of those kind of more advanced reading functions.
Well, I think that's what I was talking about on episode 16. Let me hear from my past me.
You know, if I'm going to read something in a digital format, I want to be able to do stuff to it that I can do to digital stuff. I want to be able to cut and paste from it. I want to be able to put it into folders, relate it to other stuff, link to it from my blog, email it. You know, there's just all these other things that we're used to doing now in a networked computer environment.
Yeah, Tom, so it seems like my past me was sort of agreeing with the present you here. You know, in academic...
You are always about a year ahead of me, Dan.
Thank you, Tom. just in terms of the academic applications are about kind of mixing up stuff. You know, you want to grab something from an article and stick it in a footnote or something like that. It's just when you've got a dedicated device like this rather than a universal device, makes it just much harder to do. Well, we didn't want to wrap up the feature story just quite yet because we wanted to talk about this Google announcement in terms of sticking a million books on devices like the iPhone, which seems like a natural competitor to the Kindle. Would you guys assign books on if people had iPod touches or an iPhone or an Android phone, which Tom, you now have? Are you going to read the classics, the pre-1923 books, which are in the public domain, on your Android phone when you go on vacation?
Not when I'm on vacation. I think the one place I might possibly do this is the metro, but I just can't see doing it at home on vacation or wherever I have something, a larger screen or access to a paper copy of one of these books. But it is, I've tried it out. It's pretty cool. It works very well. The interface for Android is great. It's an interesting development, but I don't think it's really something. It's not something that I would sit and read. I might if I'm the other use case would be if I'm out and I really want to pull up a quote that I, or just pull up get a specific selection of text and I just sort of on the go need it. That would be interesting. But other than that, I don't really see it as an ebook reader. Although I know people are reading ebooks on their iPhones all the time.
Mills? Yeah, and from a teaching standpoint, I think this has got tremendous possibilities, especially since I teach 19th century European history. A lot of the books that I assign to my students now through Google Books are 19th century publications, and so the copyright's not an issue. And so I can actually, ever since I read this announcement, I've been sort of spinning around in my mind various possible applications. You know, it's still a few years away because, not all my students have this capacity. But if you're listening, Steve Jobs, I could use about 30 iPhones to do a little testing of some ideas I've got for the classroom. Because and more to the point, outside the classroom, having people, walking through downtown D.C. and reading travelers' accounts of Washington from 1897. And, they can all pull them down. And I say, okay, now turn to page 42 and we'll read this description of what the Capitol looked like in 1897.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah.
So, those kinds of applications, I think, are just right at the very they're in the realm of possibility, and I think we'll see more and more of that.
Yeah, that's a great use case, and it'll be interesting to see. There are some slight interface differences, and I wonder about at least when I looked at Google Books on my iPhone, the act of kind of scrolling with your finger versus the feel of flipping a page on a Kindle, and whether that will mean a lot to people. But I think as YouTube has shown, as we just discussed in the opening and in our news roundup, people are willing to kind of forego high definition and some nice trappings to kind of read things or see things in a convenient package. And certainly a million or more books for free is one of those packages. Time once again for our picks of the episode. These are links, software we found, or even offline reading that we think our audience might be interested in. Mills, what did you have for us for this week?
Mine's a relatively new blog called Futures of Learning, and it's a collaborative blog. I don't know, there are 8 to 10 contributors to this blog. It's funded by a MacArthur Foundation grant, and one of the things it's doing is, I mean, its main purpose is to look at the way that digital media are being implemented in learning environments. And what's nice about it is, A, that it has a very international perspective. Right now, there's a two-part series. There's a series going on. Part two just got published yesterday or today on new media practices in Korea, for instance. And so it gives you a much kind of wider frame for thinking about the ways that new media are used in learning environments. The other thing I think that's really nice about it is that it's learning environments. It's not the classroom specifically, but I think they've taken a much broader view of what a learning environment is. And so I've really been enjoying reading some of the earlier posts in this blog.
Great. Okay. We'll check that out. Thanks. Great blog recommendation. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
I've got two kind of federated search union catalog type websites that I've been playing around with. The first one is from UCLA, is a catalog of digitized medieval manuscripts. And the two are sort of different in the way they go about things. This is designed to be more of a union catalog of already digitized medieval manuscripts online, and it looks like they're mostly entering this data by hand and creating a kind of one stop discoverability for medieval manuscripts online. And right now it's just launched, and it just has a few hundred entries, but they're growing and plan to have thousands. And then the other one is called JURN, J-U-R-N.
I think I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a Google custom search of over 1,200 free scholarly e-journals in the arts and humanities. And so it's a federated search of, you know, the History Cooperative is in there, a bunch of other kind of open or semi-open e-journals are in there. And so it's a kind of a one place where you can go and search the contents of a lot of different journals. I was playing around with it for some of my own research for history of museums. It didn't seem all that useful yet to me for my specific searches, but I wonder, I'd like to hear what the audience thinks for their searches, how it works for them. So those are two different places where sort of you can go to simplify your searching online.
Sounds great. And of course, we'll link to that from digitalcampus.tv. Well, my pick for this week is I'm always looking for really interesting data and ways to access data that you might want to use in a digital humanities application. And I have to say I'm blown away by the release this last week of the New York Times article search API. So API is an application programming interface, and this one gives you access to 2.8 million articles going back to 1981 that you can access by automated processes. You can sign up and get a special key, and then program these kind of automated extractions from this incredibly rich archive of New York Times material. And I think just in general, it's really fascinating for those of us in academia or libraries and museums to follow what's going on with a movement over at the New York Times called New York Times Open. I think they just had an article about this group recently, but they called them a renegade group within the New York Times. But there is a group of young programmers and project managers over at New York Times that are really opening up the databases of New York Times and just allowing developers and others to kind of come in and see what they make of it. And if you're really interested in something like text mining or, you know, setting up keyword or tag clouds, you can use this article search API to really extract fascinating material from the last 30 years of the New York Times. You know, you can pull up recipes in automated fashions. You can look at the frequency of word use over the last 30 years. I think it's really just a gold mine. And New York Times article search API, check it out, see what you think. I don't think you need to be too technically sophisticated to take a look at the documentation and get a sense of the ways in which you might use this on your own site. So again, we'll link to that and all of our other picks for the week and other links mentioned on this podcast at digitalcampus.tv. We do hope you join the conversation conversation by posting your own links and thoughts on our blog and our website, and also follow us on Twitter.
Don't use Twitter. Don't use Twitter.
At Digital Campus. And we will hear from you all over the next 2 weeks, and we look forward to talking again, Tom and Mills. Thanks very much at another edition of Digital Campus.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.